Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 471 for comics originally released on August 17th, 2016. Now, starting us off in DC is Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 1. This is written by Julie and Shauna Benson, and we've got art by Claire Rowe. And I'll be honest, none of these names are really ringing a bell for me.
Aren't the Bensons Hollywood people? They do stuff like maybe Supernatural. Does that sound right?
I don't watch Supernatural, so they could entirely be right in why I don't recognize them. I'm not saying they're rookies. I'm just saying I don't know who they are.
I think they're TV writers. Okay. I wouldn't swear my life to the Supernatural tie-in, but I'm pretty sure they're on a show. They're showrunners.
That wouldn't surprise me, because I thought this felt like it was paced not as a traditional comic book to a degree, and I mean that in a good way, actually. I mean, a fair amount happens in here. But overall, this is one of those where there are parts of it where I'm going to go with kind of a good but not great mindset here of there were just little things that didn't work for me, and other people may love them. But, like, the thing starts with a caption of, you know, Gotham City rush hour, followed by, just like all the other hours. Like, it's a quippy little saying underneath the location caption, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. It wasn't a deal breaker, but it didn't work for me. It didn't add any. And there was an aspect of this issue where the characters just didn't quite feel entirely like we see them elsewhere. Batgirl's a bit too obsessed with finding this new Oracle, and she's typically a bit more calm, cool, collected and stuff, and not seeing that here. In other words, this character feels a little different than the Batgirl I've been reading for the last few years, or the one I'm reading, trying to remember exactly from her book, but at least, I mean, I just read an issue of Nightwing that she was in, which of course begs the question of how she's here in Gotham doing this, when over in, I think, both her book and Nightwing, she's in Japan. But that brings to mind, how does Black Canary have time to be doing all of this if she's out hanging with Green Arrow in whichever city he's in these days? I forget if it's Star City or Seattle or Portland or wherever the hell he is. And then the Huntress we get here is far more of an aggressive take on the character than I felt we got over in Grayson. And I don't know why she's suddenly so obsessed with hunting down the killers of the Bertinelli family. And that right there, the killing of the Bertinelli family, her family presumably, kind of set this book off on a weird note for me, because if I recall correctly, and I may not, it's been a couple of years, when the New 52 started, there was a Huntress miniseries that it's like, well, is this part of the New 52? Is it not? What's going on? With the Helena Wayne Huntress on presumably Earth, I believe Earth 1 at the time, because I think they referenced it in the World's Finest series after that, posing as Helena Bertinelli.
Well, this was before the Huntress and Power Girl thing?
Yeah, but okay. It was that Huntress.
Okay.
Okay?
Earth 2's, okay.
Earth 2's Huntress, because, I mean, there's the two heroic Huntresses we've had in the DC Universe over the decades are the daughter of Batman, Helena Wayne, and then the daughter of a mob family, Helena Bertinelli. And then when they introduced the Helena Bertinelli and Grayson, I never really felt we got, and maybe I missed something, but I never really felt we got a good backstory on her. And now they're kind of saying, well, she's the equivalent of the pre-Flashpoint mob daughter version of Huntress, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And for me, it's like, oh, it kind of makes sense. It kind of doesn't. It just, if they had decided this is Renee Montoya as Huntress or something, it would have made as much sense as the direction they went. And it's not bad. But it was one of those things that, you know, my mind is apparently too continuity ridden at times, and just trying to fit all of this together in a way that kind of sort of makes sense with how these characters are currently being used elsewhere. It didn't blatantly violate it, but it wasn't in enough alignment to totally work for me. But it was still a good story. You know, I felt we got a fair amount of action and story, but I did feel that it was lacking a little bit in context and motivation. So I was having a hard time getting why I should really care why this was all a big deal to these characters. How did this issue work for you? Because I think you're coming in with a lot less baggage than I am.
It seems to be the case from week to week most of the time. I really enjoyed the Rebirth issue, and this felt very much a part of that. They're continuing to build their friendship, and there's that underlying mission of, you know, let's go get the foical, the fake oracle that's out there. And you know, I like that's the driving force. And now we've got another mission on top of that with the Huntress's mission. But you can see that they're warming to each other, as you knew they were going to, and they were going to start relying on each other and becoming a team. And that's been fun. I really thought this was a pretty solid issue. It felt like 20 pages. If you recall last week, we talked about Superwoman and how we felt that they did an amazing job with their 20 pages because it felt like a lot more story was crammed in there. This felt like a breezy read, and not a lot was going on, because by the time you kind of moved the needle forward, you were done.
I guess to me, it felt like a lot happened, but more in a snapshot kind of a way. It's almost like a strobe effect, where we're getting a lot of little scenes. So on that respect, because there are more scenes, it feels like more happens. But I get what you're saying, that the total substance, even though they're switching gears a bit, there's not the level of depth and density of story that we got in Superwoman last week. But I think it was not the typical, I don't want to say decompressed sort of story we get, but you know what I mean.
Right.
I felt that this had a little bit more. Maybe it's just the number of scenes they had and how they kept cutting from here to there that left me thinking it had more story, but I needed more story because I didn't have context. Does that kind of make sense? I guess I'm kind of unhappy on both sides of the spectrum, if that makes sense. Or not overjoyed on both sides, because I'm not unhappy. I liked the issue, but I didn't love the issue.
I really think the artist, you said the name is Rowe, correct? I thought Claire Rowe.
Yeah.
Claire Rowe. I thought she really did a good job. You know, I kind of had a bad taste in my mouth that, you know, they got rid of Babs Tarr, and I thought she was doing an amazing job. And I see that, you know, they've kept her reinvention of the Batgirl costume. And even she still has that youthfulness. Some of the areas she looks even younger than I think she should. But all in all, I thought what the art was really high quality and really a joy to look at.
One of the things I'll say about the art is there was a definite sense of acting in it. The characters aren't just posed, they're emoting in various ways. They are reacting to things, almost to the point of overacting in a few cases. But it gave it a sense of personality or whatever that we often don't get in some other comics.
Yeah, there's the fight scene between Batgirl and Huntress where they're fighting each other, and you know, there's some very Three Stoogian blocks and slaps and things that are going on, and it felt a little silly in some of that staging. But you know, that's part of the story and the way they wanted to present that their skirmish, but it didn't feel as serious as superheroes fighting I thought should be.
Yeah, it had a little different tone than I think you would typically get in, say, like a Batman fight scene or something.
Yeah. Yeah. If a couple of Robins are fighting, I don't know that they're doing, you know, arm crosses to block things and things like that. I think it's more fisticuffs and wild swings.
Given the Robins we have these days, absolutely. I think it's a much more, because I'm trying to think which of any of the four Robins, if you include Grayson, would kind of hold back in any way, shape, or form. I mean, if they're going to fight each other, I expect them to go all out.
Yeah.
You know, none of this, you know, block it with crossed arms, because odds are you're fighting, like, Damian, who's coming at you with a sword, or Jason, who's coming at you with a gun. You know, you react differently at that point.
And when they introduced the ASP here, they did it with kind of like a bubbled letter that were the panels were inset inside these bubbled letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I breezed right over them. I knew it was supposed to spell something, but I just went to the next page, saw there were snakes around, and then went flipped back, kind of looked at it again to recognize that it was Hiss. I didn't think it was very clearly drawn at first, so I had to kind of go back and check that out again. But these are nitpicks. I think the art is high quality.
I think the art's good. I think the artist will improve as she does more pages.
Yeah.
But she's starting from a good position in terms of just the anatomy is good, the perspective mm-hmm. is good, the reactions and differentiation of the character is good.
Yeah.
And I think this is an artist that could definitely become a major superstar if they just, you know, continue to, you know, grow as an artist.
Now, there was a scene where Batgirl called Commissioner Gordon
mm-hmm.
as Batgirl. And I thought we had established, did we not establish in the New 52 that he had realized who she was and knew it all along, or had figured it out a long time earlier? Or was that like an Elseworld story that I had read?
I don't recall.
Okay.
The continuity at DC has shifted enough times that I no longer really trust my memory on some of those things, to be honest.
Yeah, you know, between, you know, I'm, you know, when you read Injustice and some of the other things that are
yeah.
out of continuity, they start to blend and you're thinking, well, okay, now did that happen in for real, in quotes, or was that just made up, in quotes, when of course they're all made up.
But the funny thing is, I would argue Injustice is actually closer to continuity, if you will, than what continuity is. Because I think that's one where they've stayed true to the core concepts and nature of the characters, even though they've diverged because of the situation.
Whereas DC's lineup would be 4 or 5 titles because everybody else is dead.
Pretty much. But I'd be really interested in the Dead Man title.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard to keep track of where things are at in continuity, who knows what and why, because they've played a little fast and loose at times.
And, you know, I'm glad that they brought some semblance of Oracle and the fact that Batgirl was Oracle for a while back into this rebirth universe. The New 52 had kind of buried that, dismissed that. It never happened. That sort of thing. So it's kind of cool to resurrect that. And they're actually not just acknowledging that it happened, but it's going to be a part of the storyline. So that's cool. I'm glad that they've recognized that and have improved upon it.
I got a quick question about that scene where Batgirl is calling Commissioner Gordon.
Okay.
Okay. Clearly, if you look at his phone, it looks like a typical office kind of multi-line phone, whatever. But if you look at the phone she's using,
that looks like a rotary.
I was thinking that too. I mean, that's just funny.
Where are you going to find those?
Yeah. Well, and it's the kind of thing that there are enough artists working in various places in the world that I can see where you would wind up with a couple of things that they just don't realize aren't, you know, how a North American would see things. You know, not often, but sometimes. But this is, I don't know if anywhere in the world is still using rotary phones. I could be wrong. I honestly don't know. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah. It looks at first glance like it could be, but then again, those could just be the buttons that you push. They're not laid out properly.
Yeah, I'm also trying to figure out how the handset rests on that. It looks like it may just be an old style phone because it's a rich guy who's, you know, into antiquity or something. I don't know.
Yeah, he's also sitting on a chaise lounge too. So you don't see a lot of those.
Yeah. So overall, I thought this was good. It's a little hard to reconcile what's going on with some of these characters versus what's going on with these same characters elsewhere in Rebirth, but that's nothing new, you know, and I'm certainly not going to ding the title for that. I liked it. I didn't love it. There was something that at some level just didn't excite me the way some of the other titles are doing. Again, I'm going to point towards, you know, Action and Detective as some prime examples there. Where it's just, wow, this is great. Or even Superwoman last week. There are some books that are just, I think, firing on all cylinders. And this is above average, but I think it's got a little room to improve before I would get to where it's like, yeah, this is amazing. So I'm going to go with a B minus. I think it's worth checking out, but it's not something that reminded me of the glory days of Birds of Prey.
Yeah. I was hovering at the B plus area, and I'm going to give it the B plus, just because I enjoyed it. And I think the art was a cut above. It's out of that A range just because it doesn't pack enough in here to deliver the A ratings for me. But really a good comic and a title that so far so good, two issues in, and worth reading.
Fair enough. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yep.
This is Star Wars Poe Dameron number 5. It is written by Charles Soule. We've got Phil Noto on the art, and I mean, geez, what a great creative team. I'm happy with what they've been doing on this series by and large. This issue was no exception. I enjoyed the story. I enjoyed the art. The whole prison break plotline they got going on was kind of fun, but frankly, not a ton of progress was made in this issue on that whole thing. So I was kind of just figuring, well, this is a mini series, which it's not, and they'll be wrapping up the storyline this issue, and they didn't, but that's just bad expectations on my part. There's something about the pacing on this where they're telling a bigger story than I was expecting, and therefore my estimation of the pacing, it felt a little off. But I'm willing to say that's on me, not on on Charles Soule. I did like how it was clear at one point that Poe Dameron went into this situation knowing there was going to be some unanticipatable things, and he had planned ahead. And when we get to, you know, him calling up to BB-8 and stuff, to me that's where the issue kind of got both very interesting and a little cryptic, because all we get is the beeps and the warbles and stuff like that from the droids. But the whole concept of a couple of astromech droids essentially becoming maybe the heroes of the story, I felt was fun, and they did some cool stuff with it here. How did this issue work for you? And have you been reading the whole series?
Yeah, I've been reading. I've been all in the Star Wars universe, and there've been a couple of these lately that made me question that. I struggled to make it through the full run of Kanan, losing interest as it went along, and barely finished out the string here. This one I haven't really liked from the very beginning, and I was about to drop it when we decided to review this one, so I thought I'd give it another. This issue did not change my mind. I thought a bit of a snoozer. I think the whole series has been a snoozer, and out of obligation to my love of Star Wars, I think it's the only reason that I'm still on it. And the art here is at some point they really, you know, try to get Oscar Isaac, you know, perfect, just like he looks in real life. And then sometimes it kind of wavers back and forth. And that's the struggle with all these Star Wars books is how close to photo reference and how close to the actor's license likeness should you get. And some of the better ones do a better job of this. And I didn't like the way it kind of moved in and out.
I do think that's a challenge with any licensed property, because you need to be close enough to be clearly identifiable as to which character is which. But it's easy if you're too close for it to feel stiff and lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough.
Well, and there are panels where it's like, oh, that looks spot on. That's Oscar Isaac. And then there's others where you're like, boy, that's not even close.
Mm-hmm.
And you just drew him over there. So why? What happened? And so, since if he was consistently drawn one way, whichever way you go, okay, I'm cool with that. But flopping back and forth drives me nuts. The huts, I didn't like the look of the huts at all. And it might be because Jabba is my go-to hut. And there are many, many huts, I guess, in the world. So they're different types.
What about these huts didn't work for you?
They didn't look big enough. They looked, in some frames, they just didn't look like they were proportioned properly.
I took that to be that Jabba was so successful, he was the biggest and happiest and fattest of the lot.
Yeah.
So these are leaner, you know, able to move around type huts. They don't need their food brought to them kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's possible. But they don't look like a hut should look in my head.
Fair enough.
And so that these are just little problems I have with it. I mean, I was pretty much bored throughout the whole thing anyway, so there's nothing in the story that was compelling me to enjoy it anymore. So I feel like I've given the Star Wars universe ample opportunity to bring me in, and I'm still enjoying Darth Vader until it ends, and I'm still enjoying the Star Wars title, and even the Han Solo title is pretty good. But I think I'm leaving this one alone and letting it go, because it wasn't that good.
I think the big problem with this title is the pacing, because this felt like a chapter of a story in one where not enough progress was being made during this chapter. So if I think they picked up the pace a little, that would help a lot. For me, the fact that, you know, Poe had a plan and we're starting to see some of it play out. Okay, I like that. That, you know, the bit with the astromechs, by and large, worked for me. There were one or two places where I felt the guards should have heard something that they didn't hear. And I'm like, okay. But then when the blue astromech goes and does his thing, it's like, man, I'm liking that droid. And I don't think he was ever named, at least not that I recall. But there was some fun stuff in this that I think if it had been in a movie would have been one of those really memorable scenes that everybody said, yeah, that was a cool fight scene, or, you know, mm-hmm. cool action scene, or cool, you know, one of those memorable scenes.
Yeah.
And
I think that might be the root of my problem is I am first and foremost a fan of the originals.
Mm-hmm.
And those characters are firmly established, and I know them inside and out. I've seen those movies multiple times. So their stories and continuing adventures and lost adventures are really exciting to me and interesting to me, and I'm bought in on who the characters are. Poe Dameron wasn't in the movie that much,
mm-hmm.
and didn't really get firmly established in The Force Awakens to me. He was in it some, but it wasn't to the level of like a Luke. So
right. No, absolutely. Well, Luke in the classic movies.
Yeah. Cool. Just assume I'm always talking about okay. the first three.
I was just saying, Luke.
I will never refer to
Luke in the Force Awakens. Poe had a bigger role. That's all I'm saying.
Definitely. So that could be part of it, that this not a character that is beloved to me, and since the writing didn't do anything to make this character stronger, that didn't help. I mean, I don't have to know who the character is if the writing's strong, but if I already know the character inside and out, then maybe the writing doesn't have to be as strong because I'm already bought in.
Well, about half this issue was the droids, so Poe wasn't even in half the issue almost.
Right.
So I think that didn't help it for you. And the fact that the droids are doing the beep beep world war, you know, kind of a thing and not dialogue makes the issue feel like
murder droids are great.
Yes, but they talk a lot, at least 000.
Yeah.
You know,
so half of them are talking.
Yeah, we get a decent amount of characterization and some fun stuff there. Whereas because we've got about 10 pages where it's mainly droids, those 10 pages fly by pretty quick. You know, and feel a bit more decompressed as a result of that. I mean, they worked well for me. I enjoyed what was going on with them, but I did come out of this thinking they need to move the story along faster. So the fact that you came out where you did in terms of a little bored, I wasn't there, but I can understand it. For me, this was a solid B. I think it's a great creative team, but I do think the title has some room for improvement. I think if you're a fan of this branch of the Star Wars franchise, you'll be happy. But if you're not, this may not be the book for you.
Yeah. Well, again, I was wavering between a C- and a D+. I'm maybe a little harsh, but I think I'm going to go with the D+. I just didn't think this was a good title in a series that I didn't think have been great. And so this issue really didn't do anything to sway that, just as lackluster as the others, and not something I'm going to read anymore, and I wouldn't recommend unless you're just a super fan of Force Awakens and just starved to death for anything in that universe.
Is there anything in particular they think they could have done, or you think they could have done to have improved the book for you?
Yeah, I don't know, because I mean, the other titles have been good.
But how much of that is your previous comment about really knowing Vader, Luke, Leia, that group of characters, and therefore you're coming in with favorable baggage and attachment to those characters that you simply don't have for Poe Dameron? And therefore, it's not so much this, I don't say it's not so much the story, because I mean, it is, but it's harder for them to come back from that.
Right. I can't argue with that, because my own history in the last couple of years with this universe would back that up, because Kanan, newer property, not something I'm that familiar with, less enjoyable. Poe Dameron, not that, just one movie, a few scenes that I enjoyed the movie, but I wasn't as enamored with the character. And so there could be something to that. There are other characters in other science fiction settings, The Fuse, for example, where I had zero understanding of who those characters were and was engrossed and I really enjoyed their progression and who they were. So I think it's part the writer's fault and maybe part of my baggage.
I guess the comment I would make about The Fuse and some other properties like that, where they started from a blank slate, they're not competing with another branch of a franchise. Whereas I could see somebody, again, this isn't the era of Star Wars they want, or this isn't the branch of the Star Trek franchise they want, or it's not their doctor or whatever.
Right.
So there's a little bit of a hurdle to overcome, whereas with a blank slate, you don't have that. Now, I think if you're going to go with either a new or lesser known branch of a franchise like Star Wars, there is a challenge there, because there's, again, something to compare it to, you know, the cultural icon of the movies and such. Having read a fair amount, but nowhere near all of the Dark Horse Star Wars stuff, there were a couple of things where it's like, oh, it's the X-Wing Squadron, or it's this, that. It's, yeah, it's all right. It's not bad, but it just didn't excite me. Whereas I thought, and I forget which title it was, but it was set, you know, far off on the timeline from the Luke and Leia era, but it was done by John Jackson Miller. And I thought he captured the tone, the style, and the nature of Star Wars, even though he wasn't using any of the recognizable characters. You had the same sorts, the same feeling, the way the characters interacted and stuff like that. And that's a really tough thing, I think, to pull off. And I'm not going to say that Charles Soule has done that here with Poe Dameron. I think there's a certain amount of again, trying to leverage the characters from the movies that are one movie in and are still yet to be fully fleshed out in canon. So I think it's just I don't say a tough situation, but it's one that I can see where you're coming from on how it doesn't work and, you know, why you would stop with this. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the one exception is, you know, there have been no murder droids in any pre-existing properties. Those characters were introduced, enjoyed them immensely. Aphra has never been in anything. Those characters were introduced in the Star Wars book, and I've enjoyed her immensely. So I've been able to enjoy new characters that I didn't have a preconception with at the hands of a different creator.
I guess to me, though, it's still set in the comfortable part of the Star Wars universe for you, because you're very familiar with that timeline and Darth Vader and all that. And the characters you mentioned have aspects that are similar-ish enough to some other characters. Again, the murder droids versus, you know, C-3PO and R2-D2. I can't look at the murder droids without that direct comparison in the back of my mind almost at all times.
Right. So who are you comparing Aphra to?
I'd have to give that one a little thought. I'd have to give that some thought.
And of course that's Jason Aaron.
Yeah.
Different class, different tier. So, you know, it's tough to compare other people to him because he's one of the best.
Well, and again, with Star Wars, it's such a fan favorite property that everybody kind of has their own, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if the writer's out of alignment with that, that can be problematic. So, yeah. Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is Briggs Land number 1 from Dark Horse. This is written by Brian Wood. It is, who's doing the art on this? This is Mac Chatter doing the art. I have not really read a lot of stuff by Brian Wood. I have read his Generation X issues that he co-wrote with Warren Ellis back in like 2000. I have the demo trade, but I haven't read it. I didn't read DMZ, Local, Supermarket, Northlanders, The Massive. I did read Deviate, Gods and Monsters that he wrote. It was a miniseries on the Wildstorm characters.
Starve?
Nope, didn't read that either.
But you did read his Star Wars series at Dark Horse.
You know, I'm not sure if I did or not, actually. I would have to...
It was their last series before they lost it. About 21 issues, something like that?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I've read enough Star Wars stuff, and I was, I'd have to go double check. I honestly don't know. It basically seems like the sorts of things he tends to write don't generally line up with the sorts of things I tend to read, and that's no reflection on the quality of his work. This solicitation compared Briggsland to Sons of Anarchy, which I didn't watch, and Justified, which I initially didn't watch, and it took my sister quite a bit of time badgering me for me to watch it. And basically, it was, we're going to be doing the road trip to San Diego, and this was a couple of years back. And I had a spare weekend or two. I long for those days.
Remember those days?
Yeah, no, not really. So I did what any responsible individual would do, and I sat down with the two or three seasons of Justified or whatever that were out at the time, and I marathoned them. And the tone, the style of the show, just I loved it. So when this was comparing itself to that, I'm like, okay, I'll give this a shot. And I can see similarities to Justified in terms of kind of the basic genre, a little bit of the style, and kind of, I don't say the tone or the mood, but I can definitely see where if somebody liked the Justified TV series, this is something they may want to check out. This is something.
Yeah, I don't watch either one of those. So that being solicited that way was the really the only thing that was kind of bugging me a little bit, because I was like, oh, I don't watch either one of those shows. Is this going to be a miss for me? From Brian Wood, because he's been pretty hot lately on my list, and I've kind of liked everything he's done recently. So I was a little concerned. It wasn't like they said, it's Game of Thrones meets The Wire, and I would have been all in. But there's a couple of shows that weren't something that I watched regularly. So it was a tough sell right from the beginning with this solicit.
That's interesting, because you came in for the creator.
Yeah.
And the pitch didn't quite work for you. For me, the pitch was interesting. And, while I've known of and talked with Brian Wood a couple of times over the years, I don't really, what he does doesn't tend to align with the stories I tend to naturally gravitate towards. This is making me rethink some of that, because I really enjoyed this issue. It was well done. It told me what I needed to know about these characters and such. But it is kind of interesting that we came at it from, I don't want to say diametrically opposed reasons, but very different angles.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I came on the Brian Wood train late with The Massive. Probably started reading that in like 2011, 2012 or so. And then started picking up the new stuff, because he's incredibly prolific. He's right up there with Mark Millar. He's putting out a lot of different ideas and a lot of new series, launching a lot of new series that in either are launched as limited series or end up being limited series based on sales.
Well, these days, what doesn't?
Well, I can't tell the difference anymore. So, but he just moves on to the next idea that is not really that similar to the last thing he did. And I kind of dig that. I kind of like the fact that he can do that and do them all competently and make them interesting to me. That's pretty cool.
Well, and it doesn't seem like there's any long gestation period between titles.
No.
It's like as soon as one's done, it's like, well, he's ready to go with the next. He's got ideas. And this was one where I thought going from ground zero to the end of the issue, there was a lot of story in this, a lot of information given to me, but a lot of it was shown, not told. And there's a little exposition here and there, of course, but I never felt like any character was essentially pontificating for my benefit. And again, he knows how to tell a story and how to convey information. I got interested in the plight of these characters. I got interested in what happens next. I don't think I've got future issues pre-ordered. If I don't, I'm gonna add them to my list. Because I enjoyed this. It was fun. There's talk of it being in development for an AMC television show. And I definitely think it could work that way. But it also, just like with Justified, casting the right leads will make or break that show. You know, as good as the writing is, if you don't have somebody who can really kind of sell the lines, sell the concept, and make it work, it could struggle. I think there are some premises that are almost actor-proof. Not many, but a few. This is one that I would like to see as a television show. I think it'd be fun. I'm enjoying it again as a comic. The art was solid. The pacing on the thing was good. Nothing felt cliche or like I've seen this before or like where is this coming from? It doesn't make any sense. It flowed in a natural kind of a manner. So I was pleased with this.
Yeah, there's tons to like here, and there's a lot of story here. It's, what would you say, 34, 35 pages, something like that?
Maybe I didn't count, but certainly it has more room than a standard issue.
Close to twice the big two comics, so a lot of stuff in here and a lot of story. And, you know, I'm rooting for the wife, you know, that stood up to her prisoner husband.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing they're not good people. And, you know, they've got this little compound going on, and there's, you know, some elements of some other
properties that I've
read or seen and recently, but it's stuff that I've enjoyed in other properties, and I kind of like them being all kind of mishmashed in here and those ideas being explored a little. So the plot is cool. The characters are cool. I was a little confused on what happened to a couple of the brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Where they went. They changed sides.
I think that confusion is intentional near the end and may or may not get resolved in the next issue. I think that's one of the big crux of the series of,
yeah,
what's going on there. What I thought was interesting in terms of the history of the Briggs family was the inside front cover had a little paragraph about it. And
In my review copy.
Oh, okay. In the print copy, inside front cover. For generations, the Briggs clan were content to live free and peaceful lives. But with the rise of religious extremism and the Age of Terror, their activities have turned criminal. When I first read that, for whatever reason, right or wrong, and I'm maybe wrong based on having just reread it, I took it to be that they had continued kind of doing what they had always been doing, but because of the change in society, these things were now being deemed illegal, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, yeah, we could turn a blind eye, but no. In this day and age, nah, that's you're going to go to jail for that sort of a thing. But then later we get the why Jim Briggs is in jail for a life sentence. And I'm like, no, that's no matter how you look at it, that was always going to be illegal. That was, you know, he's in there for a reason. Yeah. Ironically, I actually know what Jim Briggs. Nothing like this one whatsoever. Matter of fact, I would say diametrically opposed. But I
not a skinhead criminal.
Not at all. Yeah, there were a couple of pages, no dialogue or whatever. Just the story was conveyed well in them, nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
I like creative teams that can do that without those pages seeming like they just fly by and there's nothing there. I'm curious where this goes. I'm curious how the pacing of the series goes. This was at the end marked as one of three. I don't think that means this is a three-issue miniseries, but
no, I think that was
the first arc. Yeah,
that was how I took that. Yeah,
yeah. For me, this is an A-. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad I read it, and I need to order the other issues.
Yep, I'm also at an A-. Really excited to see where this goes. I'm looking forward to maybe some flashbacks on this marriage. Why did she stick around for as long as she did before she finally reached the breaking point? I'm curious about that. A lot of stuff with the brothers I'm interested in. The retaliation from the husband from prison and He seemed to have his fingers all over the place. There's a lot of exciting stuff in here that was laid out and set up for us for future issues that I'm excited to read. So I'm ready to jump on issue 2, and a really good read and the best of the week.
This is something that, because of the nature of the story and whatnot, I could see aspects of interpersonal relationships and just the power alliances going back literally generations. And it could be fun to get either in an annual or a one-off story somewhere else. How did the Briggs Land start? Get some of the history of all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, in addition to all the story potential you're talking about in present day, I think there's a ton going back in time as well.
Yeah, it's just, it's really impressive to me. Creators like Brian Wood and Greg Rucka and some others, you know, Kayvon, that can, they can just create these worlds of nothing that are so deep and complex, and they have backstory, and they probably have backstory upon backstory that they don't even use, but they've got it anyway, just so they can fuel their imagination for the next story. It's really impressive stuff, and you can see that this is a big world that he's created from just one issue, and that there's a lot of corners to explore.
Well, and it's one of those things that even if all of that backstory never hits the page directly, the ramifications of the creators having that certainly hits the page, because there's an internal logic and consistency to the world and the story that you don't get otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Hawkins will kind of show you behind the curtain a little bit in some of his books. In the back, you know, some of the research that he's doing, some of the way, how he got from A to Z. Mm-hmm. And maybe it only meant a line in the dialogue or one little piece of the plot. But he has, 7 hours of research there tagged for you to see where he got the inspiration for what he was trying to say there. That's kind of cool.
Well, but I think it also colors the characters and the story in a less perceptible manner.
Yeah, they have depth.
Well, they have depth, and he's thinking in the back of his mind, there's this aspect of science or the backstory or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that would lead the story in a direction it would not have otherwise gone in had he not done that research, had he not thought things through. So I love it when writers take that time to really not just hone the craft on execution, but explore the concept, build out the world, design it out, do kind of that architectural drawing, if you will, of the story, at least conceptually, before just starting and just putting pen to paper or hands to keyboard or whatever. You know, because I think it, in the cases you've mentioned, it's definitely paid off in the long run for a number of properties from all of those creators. They've just got a depth you don't otherwise get.
Yeah, and that stuff works for me a lot. It might not work for everybody else, but that's the kind of stuff that really keeps me coming back in that series. And then when that artist or that creator does something else, I'm already kind of halfway in the bag. Because of the good time that I had last time and the respect that I have for the process, the previous incarnation. So that just keeps me coming back.
Well, you know, they're taking the job seriously for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they're not just throwing something out there to see what sticks. It's they're investing their time and their effort into it. And I respect that and appreciate that.
But then, there are creators like Brian Michael Bendis. I don't think he does that, but he's just so... He's able to spin, he's able to write dialogue, he's able to write a story so easily and effortlessly, it feels like, when you're reading it, that, you know, he could just, you know, write a story about two guys having a conversation in a phone booth for a 6-issue arc, and it would just flow.
I think I read that. I'm kidding.
I think that was Age of Ultron.
I was going to go with Ultimate Hulk versus Wolverine, but all right.
But still, I mean, it's... No matter how much we talk about the decompression, it's still quality writing. And so there are different ways to get at this.
There's quality execution and writing and dialogue and stuff like that. And you're right, there are some people, and Bendis is one of them, that are amazing at that. But to me, if you pair somebody like that, who's unbelievably good on the execution side, with somebody like a Rucka, a Woods, a Brian Kayvon, you know, the people who really think their stuff through, then you can get the best of both worlds. Because you can get a story that's got the intricacy that the people who are really polished on the execution, but don't take the time to go to that depth, you're not going to get the complexity or the subtleties of the story. Mm-hmm. Yet sometimes with the guys who are spending all their time doing that, you know, well, and this is a case where I think we got a really polished execution, as I would expect from Brian Wood. So I don't know that these guys need the help.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a for like a weekly series like 52 and things like that, there comes a point where you need a little of both.
Yeah, you need a different skill set.
Somebody who can do kind of the plot lining and orchestration of events, and then people who can just get that and make it flow naturally and entertainingly. Likewise, you need the same sort of thing on the art for that sort of a deal. So,
what do you think of the art on that book? We didn't really talk about it much. It was above average.
I liked it. I thought it was good. It
a little scratchy in places. You
little scratchy, but not like it felt like they were not rendering the thing fully or whatever.
Right.
You know, there was an aspect of it where it's a particular kind of style. There's something I'm thinking I should be equating it to, and I'm blanking on what that is. I liked it. It worked.
Lee Lowridge colors are really good too. They're, you know, you can tell a book like by him, and I like his style.
To me, the art never got in the way of the story. It facilitated the story on a really good level,
mm-hmm.
Which is part of why the thing I think worked for me as well as it did. You know, the art was never, artist was never fighting with the story. And I've seen some where it's like the two are not on the same page, the writer and the artist. But I think particularly from somebody like a Brian Wood, and I would extend this to Rucka and some of the others as well, they typically partner with artists and not just, hey, find somebody to draw the book, if you know what I mean. They take the time to make sure they've got the right artist for the property, I think. And that can make just a world of difference.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, it doesn't make sense at the time. Like the first couple issues of The Massive, you're thinking, I'm not sure if the art's up to snuff here. But as the series progresses, you can't think of anyone else drawing that book. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got to be Gary Brown. So, yeah, I think you're right. The best writers, you know, they find the right artists and to pair with, and they don't just take next guy up.
Well, and they get a sense of what does that artist want to do, how do they work, and try to find the right interaction with the artist. Because it's not something where, I mean, the workflow between an artist and a writer changes depending on the artist and the writer is what it comes down to. Again, fun stuff.
Good stuff, yeah.
I've read a couple other things this week, but honestly, I think I got further behind versus getting more caught up this week. I had the Mayo reports to record, a few other things to do, so it may take me a little while to get caught up. What did I read this week? I read Aquaman, Batman, Fallen from Marvel, Injustice Gods Among Us, Justice League, Nightwing, and probably not much else, actually. A few things from some of the previous weeks, nothing that really jumps out as, oh wow, we've got to talk about it. I've still got stuff going as far back as July 13th. I may just try to finish that week off and start moving forward. If for no other reason, then I can move a week's worth of comics out of the way around my desk.
It's
piling up.
Yeah, August 3rd took me a long time. There was a lot more books than I thought. I'm making my way through the 10th, so I'm about a week and a half behind, I guess. But I'm enjoying my comics, and that's the name of the game, not rushing.
Yeah. I want to get caught up just because it's less comics to keep track of, and they're coming out at a fairly quick rate.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm reading them for enjoyment is a lot of it, too.
And, you know, sometimes I'll jump, like the DC stuff that's coming out every other week. You kind of want to read those back to back. So you're jumping in from one week to the next and then going back to try to catch up. That can be kind of problematic.
It certainly slows down my reading process.
Yeah.
Which is part of why I may just go back to the, okay, here's the week of of July 13th.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take the top one off the stack, read it, and move down.
That's the age old process.
Hey,
it's tried and true.
It's simple. It might even work.
It might even work. Yep.
Coming up, we've got the comic book page teleconference. I brilliantly scheduled that for September 3rd, which is a Saturday in the middle of Labor Day weekend at 7 p.m. If people are going to show, please post on the forum so I know that I need to be there. One of the things that was suggested by Sam, and it's actually an incredibly simple idea that's I'm surprised I didn't think about it. Maybe we should move this to like the week after the preview spotlight deadline. So, which is going to be, in this case, September 10th. So if I'd actually been thinking, I would have scheduled it for September 17th. We're not going to do that. We're going to keep it on the 3rd unless people on the forum all say, no, let's move it. Just because I don't want people to, you know, get confused as to when it is. Although I probably just confuse them. But then
the original idea for having it that previous week was because it would drive conversations based on the previews catalog?
It was a little bit of that to you know, allow people to discuss what they were going to pick or whatever. But it was not doing it the same weekend, because at one point it was scheduled for the same Saturday that the deadline was.
Yeah.
The problem was, in this particular case, as happens frequently, of September 10th, that's not only going to be the deadline and the Saturday I'm going to be doing the editing and stuff of the preview spotlight, it's also going to be the weekend the numbers come out for August, so I'm going to be busy doing that in the article.
It always seems to line up that way.
Sometimes they split to different weeks, but it often lines up that way. And that's busy enough, adding a, you know, spend a couple hours talking with people online. While it's fun to do, it's hard to fit into that weekend. So I had moved it forward a week thinking that was the better plan, but I'm thinking do it the week after and that might work better. But I'm opening it up for listeners to chime in and let me know what they think. Because, I mean, the whole point is to get people together and talk about comics. So whatever works best for people. You know, I've got some flexibility in my schedule, but I've also got some inflexibility in the schedule based on other commitments. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that's a show.
Cool. Join us next time as we discuss Blue Beetle Rebirth number 1 from DC, Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur number 10 from Marvel, and Kingsway West number 1 from Dark Horse.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.